Sehr geehrte Damen und Herren, verehrter Herr Professor Sturz, verehrte Frau Sturz, es ist mir eine große Ehre und eine wirkliche Freude, heute die 7. Gerald-Sturz-Vorlesung zur Geschichte der Menschenrechte und der Demokratie zu halten. Ich hoffe, Sie finden es nicht anmaßend, wenn ich bemerke, dass sich die Forschungsfelder von Herrn Sturz und mir, wenn man in einem starken Maß überschneiden. Uns beiden gilt als Hauptinteresse die, wenn man so will, lange Geschichte der europäischen und transatlantischen Aufklärung vom 18. Jahrhundert bis in die Abgründe des 20. Jahrhunderts, von Demokratie und Menschenrechten bis Nationalismus und Genozid. Uns beide verbindet aber noch etwas anderes, und zwar die früh schon im Studium geweckte Zuneigung zur anglophonen akademischen Welt. Und so ist es vielleicht ganz passend, wenn ich heute als Berliner und Preuße eine Vorlesung zu Ehren eines Wieners und Österreichers auf Englisch halte, der Lingua Franca unserer globalen Welt und auch der neueren Menschenrechtsgeschichte. Let me start with what is perhaps a provocative claim. Historians are the embalmers, die Leichenbeschauer, of our political and moral convictions. As soon as historiography begins to take an interest in an issue, we can be certain that it no longer possesses a self-evident presence in our society. Not because historians as a rule are such critical intellects, but rather because certain questions and problems only become objects of history at all after society has become historically conscious of them. The history of workers boomed in the 1970s, for example, when industrial labor was in the process of disappearing. Just as memory and its sites were discovered as an issue of history in the final decades of the 20th century, precisely at the moment when lived memory of the age of extremes was disappearing together with its last generation. The enthusiasm for human rights has by no means come so far, even if a certain historicizing sobriety has set in. On the contrary, as I have argued elsewhere, human rights are still something like the doxa of our times, those ideas and sentiments that are tacitly presumed to be self-evident truth and not in need of any justification. Who among the cosmopolitan elites of the West is opposed to human rights today? And who of those born before the 1970s would like to be reminded that earlier he or she had little or no concept of human rights? At least in the West today, the claim to human rights is so universal and unassailable that in principle, the only thing still debated is how they can be best realized on a global scale. And yet, it is remarkable that historians have begun to concern themselves with human rights only recently, essentially only since the late 1990s. The studies by Gerald Sturz and his students, in particular Margarete Grantner or Brigitta Bader-Zahr, are really an exception here. In the major historical synthesis of the past two decades, for instance, the interpretations of the 20th century by Eric Hobsbawm and Tony Judd, or of the 19th century, more recently, by Jürgen Osterhammel and Chris Bailey, human rights are mentioned at the margins, if at all. This is about to change, so much can be said already. As times change, so does the past. And apparently we have in recent years arrived in a new present, an era of global governance, cosmopolitan ethics, and humanitarian interventions, for which we seek anchoring points in history, but which begins at the same time to historicize itself. The new historiography of human rights can be divided into these two tendencies, one that searches for these stabilizing points for the present and finds them in the long durée evolution of human rights, what I would call deep history, and one that seeks to demonstrate in revisionist fashion the instability of such universalist narratives and thereby the historicity, that is, the transience of our political and moral convictions, what I would call recent history. Conveniently, these two tendencies are grouped around two path-breaking books, Lynn Hunt's Inventing Human Rights, which was published in 2007, and, as a counterpoint, Samuel Moyn's Last Utopia, published in 2010. Put briefly, Lynn Hunt argues that in the 18th century, human rights gained in currency because they were based on new experiences and cultural practices, a new emotional regime, the core of which was imagined empathy. That's Hunt's term. From this new emotional regime, which is evident, for example, in the moral campaigns for the abolition of torture, beginning in the 1760s, a new legal order emerged in the French Revolution that in turn followed its own cascading logic. Once human rights had acquired self-evidence, Hunt argues, they could no longer be removed from the world and unfolded their revolutionary potential during the 19th and 20th century. Sam Moyn, in contrast, objects in Last Utopia that we can speak of human rights in their current form as individual rights granted to every person even beyond the nation state only since the late 1970s, since Jimmy Carter and Disco, as one unhappy reviewer summarized his argument. Prior to this, human rights were tied to the nation state and were thus essentially citizenship rights. As the title suggests, human rights became, according to Moyn, the last utopia, especially for activists in the recently established human rights NGOs, such as Amnesty International, following the failure of other global emancipation ideologies, such as socialism or anti-colonialism. With this thesis, Moyn provides an interpretive framework for a series of more recent studies and ongoing research projects of a new generation of historians investigating the breakthrough of human rights to a global morality in the 1970s. My lecture today is intended as a historiographical intervention in this debate and develops three interconnected arguments that seek to determine the location of human rights in the crises and conflicts of the recent past. First of all, I will push the historiographical revisionism of Moyn and others even further and argue that we can first speak of human rights as a basic concept, as a Grundbegriff in the Kosalikian sense, of global politics only in the 1990s, after the end of the Cold War. Human rights idealism, I will argue, is not the cause but the consequence of the deep historical ruptures around 1990. However, this does not mean, secondly, that human rights have no deeper history. Here I agree with Hunt and others. On the contrary, in many respects, the human rights idealism of the 1990s appears as a strange revival of enlightened liberalism of the late 18th and 19th century and of its critics, of Immanuel Kant and Carl Schmitt, the two sources of inspiration and antipodes of the political and moral discourse of the 1990s. Thus, human rights are perhaps not a new and certainly not the last utopia. Rather, the question is whether the human rights idealism at the end of the 20th century can be seen as utopian at all. What appears to be new are other motives: the self-evidence of individual human rights, which stand above the rights of states, the evocation of past and present suffering as a mobilizing source, the global claims connected to human rights, and finally, the media presentism of their failed realization. That is, the ubiquity of crises and state of emergencies as a matter of course. The end time of human rights, to use Stephen Hopgood's phrase, are the global here and now, not a utopian future. From this follows, thirdly, my concluding reflection that the rise of human rights as the crisis semantics of a new fin de siècle can be understood in part as a result of the fracturing of the modern time regime. Not the future or an idealized past serves as the vanishing point, but rather the present, which appropriates past and future. The new historiography of human rights also belongs, I think, in this context. It invents for our time a history of human rights, conceived as individual and pre-state rights, which are read into the past and future as if without alternatives. In his lectures of 1867, Jakob Burckhardt used a paradoxical metaphor to describe historians' cognitive interest in the immediate past. Wir möchten gern die Welle kennen, auf welcher wir im Ozean treiben. Allein wir sind diese Welle selbst. We love to know the wave that is carrying us over the ocean, but we are ourselves that wave. Authentic crises, Burckhardt argues, are rare in history. And even if they are difficult for contemporaries to decipher, several characteristics can nevertheless be identified. The most important characteristic of crisis experiences is the element of surprise, the onset of the events. The unexpected transpires with a suddenness that acquires a meaningful interpretation only in retrospect. What for Burckhardt was the French Revolution and its impact on the history of the 19th century is for our era the events beginning in the late 1980s, in particular the end of the Cold War and the end of apartheid in South Africa, and thereby the end of the world order that had been created after the Second World War and the end of colonial empires. It might be tempting to trace the crisis of the Cold War order during the final third of the 20th century back to its moral subversion through human rights ideas and movements, just as Reinhard Koselleck had interpreted the crisis of the Ancien Régime during the final third of the 18th century as the moralization of politics by enlightened philosophy and civil society. The critique preceded the crisis. Most of the recent histories of human rights argue in a similar fashion. The political upheavals around 1990, including those outside of Europe, are regarded as a result of global human rights mobilizations that began in the 1970s. As I hope to show in this lecture, however, this is a retrospective ascription that is accurate only in part. The distinction introduced by Moyne between citizenship rights, or the rights of men on the one hand, and international human rights on the other, identifies what is decisively new about the human rights idealism of the late 20th century. In the revolutions of the late 18th and the 19th century, human rights were always tied to the idea of sovereignty, or, to put this more generally, to political participation in a democratically constituted polity. Citizenship rights and human rights belonged together, and their political location was the nation state. This was also undoubtedly the case with the emergence of human rights after the Second World War and the collapse of colonial empires. During the Cold War, human rights did develop into a language of the international community of states and its organizations, but it was largely a diplomatic language, confined to this international arena and without much political consequences. Between the end of the Second World War and the early 1990s, there was not a single humanitarian, political, or military intervention that was justified through human rights. In many respects, the inviolability of state sovereignty was the presupposition for human rights being expansively codified in international accords and treaties, a process frequently driven forward by the new post-colonial states for whom the right to self-determination was the most important basis of human rights. Parallel to the increasing international codification of human rights and their expansion in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s to continuously new collective rights, for example, the right to development, adopted by the United Nations in 1986 and largely forgotten today, some Western governments and NGOs began to discover in the 1970s individual human rights as the political and moral legitimation for a new politics beyond the nation state. Especially in the United States, human rights became the driving force for non-governmental organizations such as Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, but also for new ethically based foreign policy proclamations of the Carter administration, and then, as an intensification of the Cold War rhetoric, of the conservative Reagan government. A part of a sharpening of tone towards state social societies and the devaluing of the social and economic human rights that were supported also by post-colonial states, this invocation of human rights had still no significant political consequences in the 1970s. The United States continued to support financially and military authoritarian dictatorships in Central and Latin America, including the secret war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, as well as the terror regime of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. The popularity of Amnesty was still limited at this time. The global claims should not obscure the fact that Amnesty had organizational branches essentially only in the United States, Great Britain, the Netherlands, and West Germany, and that its members were for the most part content with just making donations. The great transnational social movements of the 1970s and 1980s were not Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, but rather the ecological movement, from which also independent political parties emerged, the women's movement, and especially the peace and anti-nuclear movement. In October 1981, for example, millions of people demonstrated in Bonn, Brussels, Paris, London, and several Italian cities against NATO's revival of the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. Human rights were not mentioned at all. It would be equally misguided to regard the events of 1989-1991 as a result of the discovery of human rights in the 1970s. The events in East Central Europe and also in South Africa were first and foremost democratic revolutions focused on classic civil and political as well as on social and economic rights and the reattainment of national sovereignty. However one might evaluate the significance of democratic protest movements in East Central Europe and, for instance, regard, as Stephen Kotkin does, the economic rather than the moral bankruptcy of elites to be the decisive factor in the collapse of state socialism, the outstanding feature of these events was the return to the nation and the nation state as the guarantor of rights and not a post-national constellation or global civil society of some kind. On the contrary, this return to national sovereignty appeared to political actors, similar to the post-war moments in 1918 or in 1945, to be the sole guarantee for rights claims and political participation, as is illustrated by the shift in the democratic mass movement in East Germany from Wir sind das Volk, we are the people, to Wir sind ein Volk, we are a people. The process was similar in other former socialist states in Eastern Europe. So we have this shift also in other former socialist states. The revolutions of 1989-1990 did not aim at pre-state rights, nor were they organized solely around individual human rights, polemically directed against social, economic, cultural, or more generally collective rights. Solidarność was not a human rights NGO that collected donations for distant suffering, but rather a labor union that demanded citizenship rights at home and also specific worker rights, which hit communist legitimacy especially hard. This coupling of rights and sovereignty claims led not only to the implosion of communism, but also to the collapse of the multi-ethnic socialist federations in the Soviet Union, but also Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, with catastrophic consequences, especially on the Balkans. Human rights were not the catalyst of these revolutions, crises, and wars, thus of the collapse of the old and the emergence of a new international order, but instead, I argue, a response to them. In many regards, the reorganization of the world after 1989 resembled the previous international settlements of 1918 and 1945. As after the First and Second World Wars, the chain of events after the end of the Cold War was also marked by the simultaneity of the implosion of empires, eruption of ethnic civil wars, the division of states and the accompanying refugee crisis and ethnic cleansings on the one hand, and the promise of democratic participation, as well as lofty visions of a new, more peaceful and just international order on the other. As it turned out, however, the human rights idealism of the 90s was distinguished from the two previous post-war eras by the fact that the invocation of national sovereignty, at least in Western Europe, unlike Eastern Europe, was perceived as an issue of the past. In this regard, the normative liberalism of the 1990s, especially of neo-Kantians such as Jürgen Habermas, also went beyond the enlightened liberalism of the late 18th and 19th century, which suddenly experienced a surprising revival in every other respect. Whereas for Kant, as well as for liberal international legal scholars of the 19th century, the cosmopolitan ethos was grounded in the society of civilized states and their legitimate power interests, for Habermas and other Western intellectuals, the nation-state was the greatest impediment on the path to a global cosmopolitan democracy that was supposed to be based on human rights. And the political upheavals in Central and Eastern Europe around 1990 were merely a rectifying revolution, eine nachholende Revolution, as Habermas asserted in 1991, that implemented what the West had long since attained: democracy, national sovereignty, market economy, civil rights, guaranteed by a constitutional state. In his own writings, by the way, Habermas himself used the concept of human rights for the first time only in 1993, in his book Fakizität und Geltung. Following Matti Koskenniemi, we can speak of an ethical turn in the course of the 1990s in political philosophy, sociology, but also in international law, and as will be shown in a minute, in international politics with individual human rights as the regulative idea. Human rights thus became the promise that the events of 1990 should acquire historical meaning. Suddenly, human rights seemed as self-evident as unregulated markets during the roaring 90s, according to the mildly ironic title of Joseph Stiglitz's bestseller, The World's Most Prosperous Decade. And it was a particular version of human rights, namely pre-state and individual, which was established incrementally in the 1990s and whose history was, so to speak, invented. To assess how quickly this transformation of the post-Cold War world occurred, let us recall two military conflicts. The 1990s are framed by two wars that bring to light the consequences of the ethical turn in international politics and international law: the Iraq War of 1990-1991 and the Kosovo War of 1998 and 1999. The first Iraq War, which began in September 1990 with Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, was the first war after the end of the Cold War. In contrast to conflicts during the Cold War, this was not a proxy war between two superpowers. The United States led a multilateral coalition against Iraq, sanctioned by the United Nations after the sovereignty of one of its member states, namely Kuwait, had been violated. This was the immediate justification for the intervention, as well as clearly expressed economic interests, control over the stability of oil production, but not Saddam Hussein's genocidal policies against the Kurds. For instance, the use of chemical weapons on the Kurdish civilian population in Halabja in 1988. In this sense, the first Iraq war was a conventional war of states and not a moral or just war. What was new about this war was something else: the dramatic superiority of the West's modern armaments technology, which allowed a conduct of war that minimized its own casualties. And also, secondly, it was the first war that was broadcast live on the television, what was termed the CNN effect, which led to the huge peace demonstrations with hundreds of thousands of participants in Western Europe and elsewhere, the last hooray of the international peace movement. The Kosovo War of 1999, in contrast, against Milosevic's Yugoslavia, continued these two developments. It was a war conducted from the air without casualties for the West, but only for the civilian population, so-called collateral damage, a neologism of the 1990s, along with the term group nation. And it was a war in which images played a central role. In every other respect, however, the Kosovo War was fundamentally different from the first Iraq War. The deployment in Kosovo was the first war conducted by NATO, ever. It was a war without UN approval against one of its member states, and thus was a war outside of international law. And finally, it was the first war conducted in the name of human rights in order to prevent genocide. Designated as a humanitarian intervention, the Kosovo War was a laboratory for the wars led by the United States and Tony Blair's Britain following the events of September 11. The rebranding of the United States as a reluctant moral superpower, cleansed of its Cold War sins in Indochina or Latin America, but too hesitant to fight genocidal evil in the world, is essentially an invention of the second war half of the 1990s. And a good case in point is Samantha Power, who started out as a young U.S. journalist during the Civil War in former Yugoslavia, and then became a human rights scholar at Harvard and ended up as a foreign policy advisor of the U.S. government on issues of human rights, and became one of the most outspoken proponents of U.S. interventionism. The overreaction of the West, especially of Western Europeans in the Kosovo War, can be explained only by the protracted earlier hesitation of the European Union and the United States to intervene in the bloody collapse of Yugoslavia, as well as by past failed interventions and the reluctance to intervene in other humanitarian catastrophes of the 1990s. So the failed intervention in Somalia, but then the non-intervention in Rwanda or East Timor or later in Darfur. The economic collapse in the 1980s, as well as the end of the Cold War, and thereby the possibility of establishing new nation-states in Europe, evident in the example of reunified Germany, contributed to the disintegration of the multi-ethnic Yugoslavian Federation following the death of Tito. The most potent economic regions, Slovenia and Croatia, declared themselves sovereign nations with the support of the West, and thereby transformed the Serbian populations in these new nation-states into a minority with limited citizenship rights. Thus began a spiral of violence driven forward especially by the attempts of former communist cadres, and at the same time the socialist ideology of the brotherhood and unity of Yugoslavia's nations and minorities. The West saw in the unfolding civil war an atavistic return of the ethnic hatred that had ostensibly been pent up in state socialist Yugoslavia, and initially didn't want to get involved at all. The turning point came only in the subsequent civil war in Bosnia-Herzegovina from 1992 to 1995, and was connected symbolically and in the global media especially to two events: the siege of Sarajevo by the Yugoslavian People's Army from 1992 to the beginning of 1996, and the Srebrenica massacre in July 1995, in which approximately 8,000 Muslim men and boys were killed by Serbian paramilitaries. As in the previous year in Rwanda, this massacre took place directly in front of UN peacekeepers, an expression of the United Nations' political impotence, and thereby also the end of hopes placed in the United Nations after the Cold War in establishing some kind of world government. The EU was not in a position to contain the conflict in Yugoslavia either, above all because Europeans wanted to continue to believe that ethnic civil wars and religious enmity were ghosts of the past. And even the United States and the new Clinton administration, following the disastrous experience in Somalia in 1992, did not initially want to be caught up in a conflict for which no geopolitical interest could be identified. A response to the political failure of international institutions in these violent, catastrophic civil wars was the breakthrough of the idea of global human rights politics by the generation of baby boomers and or student protesters such as Clinton, or somewhat later Tony Blair, Bernard Kouchner in France, or Joschka Fischer in Germany, who had come to power in the 1990s and only now discovered individual human rights. Crucial for this breakthrough of human rights idealism was its connection to Holocaust remembrance, which also peaked in the 1990s, and to the accusation of genocide that made Serbian detention camps a second Auschwitz. Precisely this connection of human rights and genocide, self-evident for us today, was historically new. Contrary to what is commonly assumed, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 was not a direct reaction to the Holocaust. The term genocide does not appear in the declaration at all. Conversely, human rights were not mentioned at all in the Genocide Convention, which was adopted in the same year. Because Raphael Lemkin's definition of genocide was aimed so narrowly at the Nazis' singular intention of exterminating entire peoples, the convention proved largely inadequate for international mobilizations against mass violence that was part of ethnic and religious civil wars prior to the 1990s. It was the imagery of civil war in Bosnia recalling concentration camps in the heart of Europe, as many contemporary commentators emphasized, and not in Rwanda, or subsequently in the bloody protracted civil wars in the Congo, which caused more than 5 million victims, that sparked the turnaround for a policy of Western intervention in the name of human rights. Western media-savvy intellectuals such as André Guzman, Bernard-Henri Lévy, and Susan Sontag made pilgrimages to Sarajevo and announced on convocation that they wanted to prevent another Auschwitz, which Western governments were ostensibly once again standing by and watching, as they had allegedly in the 1940s. The conflict in Kosovo 5 years later thus became the first test case for the new belief in military interventions in the name of human rights. In Kosovo, the connection to accusations of genocide, which today are part of the standard repertoire of military conflicts from Ukraine to Syria, drove political actions for the first time. In the words of Susan Sontag, and I quote, "There is radical evil in the world, which is why there are just wars." That's Sontag in 1999. In many respects, however, the accusation of genocide missed the nature of the conflict in Kosovo, as critical journalists already pointed out at the time. The Kosovo Liberation Army, the UÇK, armed with the arsenal of collapsed communist Albania, led a guerrilla war against the Yugoslavian People's Army in the province of Kosovo and exploited the civil war logic of escalating terror and retaliation to convince the West that Milosevic was planning to commit genocide on Kosovo Albanians. In contrast to the Bosnian War, NATO did not limit itself there to symbolic demonstrations of power, but instead declared war on Yugoslavia. NATO intervened in the civil war with airstrikes, thereby initiating, as became clear in retrospect, a humanitarian catastrophe in Kosovo. However justified the military intervention in 1999 may have been, here I am solely interested in the wording of its rationale. The Kosovo War marked the beginning of a new era of humanitarian and military intervention on the basis of ostensible genocides and human rights violations. The most important motives for the new human rights idealism can be found in the justifications for the Kosovo War. First, the preeminence of individual human rights over the rights of states. Secondly, the references to genocidal policies of the Second World War, but not, for instance, the European Colonial Act atrocities or to Cold War proxy wars in Vietnam or Afghanistan. Thirdly, the global claims of human rights. And finally, the humanitarian state of emergency that, broadcast in the media, demands a reaction here now and not in the distant future. In late April 1999, 1 month after the start of NATO's bombing campaign, Václav Havel addressed the Canadian Senate and the House of Commons in a highly regarded speech entitled Kosovo and the End of the Nation State. The president of the Czech Republic and former dissident argued that NATO was conducting a war against a genocidal regime. I quote, "This is probably the first war that has not been waged in the name of national interests, but rather in the name of principles and values. If one can say of any war that it is ethical or that it has been waged for ethical reasons, then it is true of this war." End of quote. Later, Havel continued, "This war places human rights above the rights of states. The Federal Republic of Yugoslavia was attacked by the NATO alliance without a direct mandate from the UN. This did not happen irresponsibly as an act of aggression or out of disrespect for international law. It happened, on the contrary, out of respect for the law that ranks higher than the law, which protects the sovereignty of states. The alliance has acted out of respect for human rights, as both conscience and international legal documents dictate." End of quote. In other words, at the end of the 1990s, we have the new global morality of human rights politics that places itself above the rights of states, about which Moyn speaks. The NATO intervention in Kosovo would have been inconceivable without the preceding images of massacres in Bosnia and Rwanda. It wasn't not first and foremost the United States, but rather European elites, in particular the Labour government in London, as well as the coalition of Social Democrats and Greens in Berlin, that felt obligated to act. For German Greens and their foreign minister, this was a particular challenge. After all, the Green Party had emerged from the peace movement of the 1970s and 80s. They now had to commit themselves to the new international human rights politics and had to commit to military interventions. At a spectacular special convention of the Green Party, Joschka Fischer was able to overcome embittered, even physical opposition and win over, using the argument, "Never again Auschwitz," a majority of the pacifistic party delegates for the UN, for the NATO military action. The 1990s also marked the beginning of a new era in the legal prosecution of mass violence and genocide. The civil wars in the former Yugoslavia, as well as in Rwanda, were again the crucial catalysts in the emergence of a new international criminal law and its institutions, possibly the most significant human rights legal accomplishment of the last two decades. In contrast to what is generally presumed, almost all important human rights conventions and treaties had been established already during the Cold War, driven forward especially by post-colonial, non-aligned states. For example, the two human rights covenants of 1966. The 1993 Vienna Declaration of the World Conference on Human Rights, with its emphasis on women's rights, as well as the indivisibility of civil rights and social, cultural, and economic rights, and finally the establishment of UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, belongs in many ways to this earlier framework, so still to this Cold War framework. At the same time, the Vienna Conference also constituted the beginning of the debate about the universality of human rights, which a number of Asian states opposed with the argument that human rights always had to be connected to the local context and collective. Thus, the debate about human rights as a specifically Western form of universalism also emerged in the post-Cold War era. Before, human rights were not seen as incompatible with collective rights. On the contrary, in the 1950s and 60s, it were anti-colonial politicians that had invoked human rights against Western colonialism. So it was exactly the other way around. Thus, human rights conventions and treaties of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s were still oriented around promoting the juridification, Verrechtlichung, of the world in order to make the results of decolonization, especially economic and political self-determination, irreversible in the future, and to enable a more just global distribution of economic wealth. In contrast, the innovations of international human rights law of the 1990s shifted the focus. They were located especially in the realm of the legal prosecution of past violent crimes. The International Criminal Court was established during this period, which also marked, among other things, the beginning of comparative genocide studies. Trauma, victimhood, witnessing became the key words used to create a new way of invoking the past, oriented especially around the Holocaust as the event from which human rights had supposedly emerged. This historical narrative, human rights as a reaction to the Holocaust, seems irresistible, even if some historians insist that it was not shock about Nazi genocidal policies that did generate human rights norms in the late 1940s or 50s. It is the working through of a dystopian past of individual human suffering that is supposed to lead political and moral action in the global present. This is precisely the central historic figure of thought for the new historiography of human rights, which set in during the late 1990s. Human suffering paradoxically accelerates the evolution of human rights. Well, that's the argument also in Lynn Hunt's important book. Again, these narratives do not point to a utopian elsewhere. Instead, they aim at a temporal and global expansion of the normative framework to which especially European and American elites are morally committed in the present day. To be sure, politically, United States governments have paid scrupulous attention to not fall under the jurisdiction of the international human rights doctrine and have not, for example, signed the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court of 2002, which illustrates, as critics object, the built-in inequality or imperial hypocrisy of this legal framework. When in Germany in 2004 the first major criminal complaint was filed against former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and additional politicians and military officers for torture in the Abu Ghraib prisons in Iraq, Amnesty criticized the move, arguing that it jeopardized the burgeoning international legal practice of prosecuting lower and mid-level perpetrators, primarily, it should be added, in African countries. The sensational arrest of General Augusto Pinochet in London in 1998 on the basis of an indictment by the Spanish magistrate Baltasar Garzón for torture during the Chilean dictatorship is the inconsequential exception that confirms the rule. The emergence of international criminal law, like the rise of individual human rights in general, was accompanied in the 1990s by a global expansion of humanitarian and human rights NGOs. In the new era of interventions, as Didier Fassin and Mariella Pandolfi have pointed out, military and humanitarian forms of governance outside of international law go hand in hand. Humanitarianism became the justification for extra-legal action. Precisely this is new in comparison to the humanitarianism of, for instance, the late 1960s and early 1970s, beginning with the crisis in Biafra and Bangladesh, as well as the founding of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. The actual media global interdependence of the world leads to the assumption of emergency imaginaries that require immediate action. The process of claiming traditional human rights, for example, the right to asylum, thus undergoes a transformation. Applicants must report about their traumatization and literally show their wounds, that is, document their bodily suffering. The focus is not the social and political reconstruction of the claims for asylum, but individual suffering and the emotional trauma connected to it. Humanitarian empathy, as Fassin argues, replaces rights claims. Political subjects become traumatized victims. It is not difficult to recognize how, at this point, the new humanitarianism and the motives of human rights idealism are part and parcel of what Fassin calls humanitarian government. Again, the political consequences of such moral actions and the inequalities emerging from them are by no means new. We need only recall, for instance, the humanitarian interventions of the 19th century, mainly in the Ottoman Empire. What is new is the temporality of such actions on the basis of an emergency imaginary in the here and now, which dissolves in many respects anti-colonialism's and socialism's visions of a future aimed at forced modernization. As historian Daniel Rogers has put it in his magnificent recent book, Age of Fracture, quote, "One might reach nostalgically for a fragment of the past, but the time that dominated late 20th century thought was now." In conclusion, we should ask whether the fracturing of the modern time regime is also one of those experiences of rupture after the Cold War that led to the ascent of human rights in the 1990s. Following Ryan Kozelek, François Hartog has argued that after 1989, the present advanced to the predominant horizon of expectations in a globalized world. Quote, "Without future and without past, the present regenerates the past and the future that it needs, and that valorizes the immediate." End of quote. What is fundamentally new about the human rights idealism of the 1990s is that it is not essentially a utopia, that is, an imagined place of a different, more perfect future world. On the contrary, individual human rights in many respects take the place of past futures, such as the post-empire insistence on the right of self-determination and on a new, more just economic world order, or the realization of social and collective rights within the nation states, and do so at a time which is marked by the crisis of institutions of solidarity and the advent of a new type of financial capitalism that widened the gap of inequality, what Pierre Rosanvallon has called the Great Reversal. At the same time, the past also changes into a history of the violation of present norms, from which in turn the legitimacy of these norms is deduced. Since the 1990s, the violent failure of 20th century visions of alternative futures has become the foil of our present human rights idealism. The crimes of Hitler and Stalin, genocide and ethnic cleansing, have become the moral narrative in which we tell the past and validate the present. To put it pointedly, the human rights idealism of the 1990s was a band-aid covering the fact that in this new world, even after the alleged end of history, civil wars, genocide, ideological and religious fundamentalisms of every kind were still not things of the past. Human rights morality became, as Hans Magnus Enzensberger noted already in 1993, the last refuge of our Eurocentrism. Does this mean then that human rights have no history, at least no history that does not begin in our own present? For this would be the consequence of the revisionist historiography of human rights that I have pushed here even further into the 1990s. However, in order to avoid the converse historiographical pitfall of Hunt, Yours, and others, who recount this history teleological as a precursor to our current notion of human rights, it is necessary to integrate the history of past futures, that is, the alternative political or social rights claims, into the history of human rights. In other words, those rights that have been replaced by the idea of individual human rights beyond the nation state over the last two decades. More recent histories of human rights have been interested almost exclusively in the version of human rights focused on suffering individuals. Citing the example of anti-colonialism, Moyn, for example, explicitly disputes that previous notions of human rights, which also encompassed collective rights, belong to the history of human rights at all. And in Hahn's history of the emergence of imagined empathy as the source of human rights, which in the French Revolution produced in cascades new rights claims, social rights, such as the right to work, are not mentioned at all, which is quite amazing in a book that is called Inventing Human Rights. Although they constituted the centerpiece of the Jacobin Declaration of Rights of Men and Citizens of 1793. The right of peoples to self-determination, but also the history of social and economic rights from the French Revolution up to the 60s and 70s, when it was especially post-colonial states that pushed for a more egalitarian world order, all of these are, from the perspective of international law, part of the international human rights recognized by the UN. They do not, however, appear in Moyn and Hunt and in the recent historiography precisely because they have been defined out of the Western hegemonic understanding of human rights over the past two decades. If the argument developed here is correct, that this ethical turn in global politics and international law expressed in the human rights enthusiasm of the 1990s has in many respects more to do with the world of the 18th and early 19th century than with the Cold War era, then the history of human rights has to be expanded to include a moral history of the century after the Enlightenment, a century that Moyn and Hunt have, as it were, skipped over. Even if the concept of human rights was not as central to the Victorian moral campaigns of the 19th century, the reform movement's emphasis on detail, narrative, and empathy with distant bodily suffering, for example, does resemble, in many ways, the depoliticized new humanitarianism of human rights that began in the 1970s in Biafra and Bangladesh and became hegemonic in the 1990s. And finally, we should also ask which other basic concepts of international law and international politics of previous centuries served a function similar to that of individual pre-state rights today. Mark Misawa has pointed out that at the mid-20th century disjuncture of the 1940s, human rights assumed the place of the conception of civilization, which had structured international law during the 19th century. The erosion of state sovereignty in the 1990s was accompanied by a return of this older rhetoric of universal ethics that was tied to the concept of civilization or civility. Whereas the international political order after the Second World War and after decolonization was based on the formal equality of states, the invocation of individual pre-state human rights, especially the new doctrine of the responsibility to protect, has introduced into international law and politics again a hierarchy of civilized and uncivilized states, which in the 19th century led to the justification of humanitarian and military interventions, for instance, in the Ottoman Empire. Thus, it may well be that contemporary historians of human rights resemble 19th century Victorians more than they realize. Thank you very much.